Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It's Friday, December 17th, 2021. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me with his reporting and editorial analysis. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So this is our final Friday program of the year, Andrew. You and I will return on January 7th, 2022. To close out 2021, let's open with news on the U.S. Department of Justice lawsuit to block the Penguin Random House acquisition of Simon & Schuster. PRH parent company Bertelsmann has filed its response to the Fed's attempted sanction.
Yeah. So first of all, let me say thanks for a great year of conversation. And it was quite a year news-wise. And by all accounts, 2022 is setting up to be quite a year as well. So I look forward to talking about the issues of the day with you when we return in January, including the brewing battle between Penguin Random House parent Bertelsmann and the Department of Justice over their acquisition of Simon & Schuster. As you know, Bertelsmann filed their answer this week, attacking the government's case. And the parties now have a pretty aggressive schedule and a trial date, which is set to get the ball rolling on August 1st, 2022 in Washington, D.C.
On Bertelsmann's answer, Andrew, any surprises there?
So no surprises. And you can read my boss Jim Milius' coverage on the PW site. But in fact, the filing pretty much follows the arguments that we discussed on this podcast after the DOJ announced in early November that it was going to block the deal. Our listeners will recall that I expressed a few thoughts about how the case might go. For example, I thought that Bertelsmann would certainly dispute the data used to conclude the market share of a combined Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster. And my true surprise that the DOJ case really seemed to be tied to the advances of a small slice of the very highest paid commercial authors. And sure enough, in their answer, that's exactly what Bertelsmann argued. They argued that the government's market share data is wrong, and that the data they're going to present is going to show that the deal would actually be good for the industry. And they also take aim at the government's theory that this deal is going to chill the advances of, and I'll quote with the DOJ here, anticipated top-selling books. Bertelsmann calls that a fictional category that the government hasn't even bothered to define. And I'll go back to my original comments in November and say, yeah, I think Bertelsmann actually has a chance of winning this case. Now, I certainly understand that there is grave concern about industry consolidation, and those concerns are very real. But as I said back in November, the DOJ's case for why the line is being drawn here with Bertelsmann and Simon & Schuster does not seem to be terribly well defined. And there really is a lot of latitude for Bertelsmann to convince a judge that opposition to this merger is simply not warranted. And, you know, I'll say again that I think one of the challenges out there for Bertelsmann going forward and for Penguin Random House is more or less a PR challenge, right? Public relations issue. Because if there's one thing that has become clear, it's the idea of combining these two large publishers is not popular within the industry. And given the way that antitrust is being talked about around the country, it has the attention of the public and of lawmakers, I think that there's a bit of a PR challenge here. But as I said before, fighting this case in court, Bertelsmann does not need to convince the public. They don't need to win in the court of public opinion. They just need to win in a court of law. And while the DOJ's case, I think, very nicely captures the current mood around the country when it comes to issues of antitrust and consolidation, I'm not convinced that that translates into a winning case for the government, at least not yet. But we will see.
And the Association of American Publishers is also in court. They are suing the Attorney General of Maryland in federal court, arguing that the state's library ebook law is unconstitutional and should be blocked. We briefly reported on the AAP suit last week, just as the story broke. And Andrew, you've had a chance now to read through the documents and begin to do your reporting. After speaking with a variety of legal experts, can you offer us an early assessment of the case?
Yeah, so a little background for our listeners. We've talked about it on the show quite a bit, but just as a refresher, the Maryland ebook law requires any publisher offering to license an electronic literary product to a consumer in the state of Maryland to also offer a license to public libraries on reasonable terms. And I'll admit, this suit sort of surprised me, and yet it didn't surprise me. So I wasn't surprised because the Association of American Publishers has been quite vocal about its opposition to these laws going back to May. You know, we've talked about that on this show as well. But I was kind of surprised because the AAP even admits in its complaint that most of their members, including all of the big five publishers, are pretty much in compliance with the law. So Why take on the expense of fighting a lawsuit right now that isn't impacting your members? Well, at least not yet. Which brings me to another surprise here, which is that the AAP is suing on its own as an association, basically because they say the uncertainty caused by this state encroachment into federal copyright law affects the business decisions of all their members. So there are no publisher plaintiffs in this case, and the AAP says the case is ripe because the law is set to go into effect on January 1, so the harm is imminent.
Tell us what the central claim is in the AAP's complaint.
So there are a lot of claims in the complaint. There's due process issues. There's interstate commerce issues. But in my opinion, the nut of the AAP's claim, and in the opinion of the lawyers that I've been speaking to, the nut of the claim here is that this law in Maryland is effectively a compulsory license. The AAP claims that the law will force publishers to license their works basically against their will. And the state can't do that because federal law preempts this kind of state law. Federal law governs what owners of intellectual property and copyrights can do with those copyrights. The suit seeks a declaration that the law is preempted and an injunction blocking Maryland from enforcing the law. And as I said, there are other claims in the suit, but this really is, in my opinion, the very heart of this suit. Now, is the AAP right? Maybe. You know, the multiple lawyers I've spoken to say it's complicated. On its face, despite the AAP's claims in the suit, the Maryland law really isn't a compulsory license. You know, contrary to the AAP's characterization, it doesn't directly force any publisher to license their digital works to libraries. What the law does compel is that publishers who offer ebooks to consumers also have to offer a license on reasonable terms to libraries. And the AAP is very deliberately conflating these two things, the requirement to make a reasonable offer to libraries with being forced to make an acceptable offer to libraries. But the two are not the same, lawyers say, because a publisher could very well make a legally reasonable offer to a library, and it could still be too rich for the library. And we know this because this happens all the time now as the market currently functions. And the result is the same. The libraries don't have the budget, and they don't get the ebook. So the plain text of the law does not set out any mechanism by which the publisher is being forced to adhere to state set terms or to renegotiate until the license is acceptable to libraries. Furthermore, the ebook law and the legislative history make clear that the current library ebook lending terms that are in use today by all of the big five publishers and many others are probably legally reasonable, right? There's really no basis to challenge those. So, you know, the publishers still get to unilaterally formulate and set the terms of their licenses without negotiation. Libraries don't get to negotiate their terms with publishers. Libraries can basically agree to the licenses or not. And under this law in Maryland, the state has no prescribed role in setting prices, only now a mechanism to address what might be alleged to be, you know, unreasonable practices. But when the law goes into effect, basically it's still going to be status quo for most of the AAP members because they're all in the library market now. Nothing really changes unless it does. Now, of course, a library could claim that a publisher's prices or terms as currently offered are not reasonable. Absolutely could happen. And if that happens, that would immediately animate the conflict that the publishers insist is, you know, imminent.
So is there any way that the law might function as a kind of compulsory license?
Yes. So I think that the strongest argument for the law being portrayed as a kind of compulsory license is because of what libraries do with ebooks that they license. They lend them, right? As many ebook users know all too well, consumer ebook licenses frequently write out the right to lend, as well as other rights that we enjoy under copyright, most notably the right to resell or otherwise give away our books. So in that sense, it can certainly be argued that the law doubles as a compulsory license because in theory, it might very well require some publishers to write licenses for libraries that would be different than the licenses it would offer to consumers and that they don't really want to write at all. And as the AAP claims in its complaint, that would ostensibly impact how publishers balance their business decisions. Now, broadly speaking, the AAP's claim is that the Maryland law is, well, broad, too broad. And I don't think that's without merit. You know, the law was written to be simple, but that's not always a good thing when it comes to the law, especially when you're dealing with copyright law. But we'll get more into those issues when the case is fully briefed. And I have to say, I'm really very interested in hearing more from the AAP's lawyers on its arguments. But frankly, while the nut of the case is fascinating, and I look forward to reading and hearing more about it, I'm still trying to work through the issue of the AAP standing and why the case is ripe for court right now when it hasn't even taken effect yet and certainly hasn't been invoked yet.
All right, so let's take those on, Andrew. Explore with us the AAP standing, the question of that, as well as the ripeness issue.
Yeah, so you know, I've talked to a couple of lawyers about this, and I guess what I've been trying to figure out is that for a compulsory license to exist, or something that resembles a compulsory license to exist, do you not have to have evidence that someone is being compelled to license something? And I ask that because the complaint doesn't assert that any AAP member is being compelled to do anything that it's not already doing, at least not yet. Because the AAP even admits in its complaint that most of its members already offer licenses to libraries, and the library book market is fairly robust. And it strikes me that the compulsory part here, and again, the text of the law only compels a reasonable offer, not a license. The compulsory part of this law would really only apply to what is admittedly a small set of AAP members who may not be in or may not want to be in the digital library market, or, you know, for example, might want to embargo their titles to libraries, which, of course, Macmillan tried in 2019, and the result of which was the advocacy push that actually yielded this law in Maryland. So I do question why this case should not require a named plaintiff showing that, you know, they're actually being harmed by this law. If there's an AAP member out there who's being forced to license ebooks to libraries against their will, well, isn't that when the law becomes ripe for a challenge? And I'm looking forward to a little more clarity on that question from the lawyers once we get rolling here. Because right now what we have is the Association of American Publishers, a trade association, arguing very broadly that the harm in this case and what qualifies them for associational standing to sue is basically that all their members depend on the constancy and supremacy of federal copyright law, to which supporters of the Maryland law say, well, this isn't about copyright. It's about contracts, right? It's about fair trade practices because ebooks are actually accessed through license agreements. And look, the AAP may very well prevail on its claim that Maryland's state law is preempted. But I would also say that the AAP's case for a preliminary injunction blocking the law at this stage just doesn't feel very strong right now. And I'll tell you a bit about why. Again, you know, the lawyers, I'm not a lawyer myself, but I talk to a lot of them. And there's a four-factor test, as I'm led to believe, to win an injunction. One, you have to show you're likely to succeed on the merits of your claim. And I think that's not exactly crystal clear here, despite the AAP's confidence in its position. Two, you have to show that you're going to suffer irreparable harm without preliminary relief. And I don't think that that's shown by the case pled here. Indeed, the complaint stresses that most AAP members are in the library ebook market, and this law really doesn't change anything for them when it goes into effect. It doesn't really change anything until one of these publishers is actually challenged. Factor three concerns the balance of equities between the parties. And again, I think that could be a hard one for the AAP. And factor four, the injunction has to be in the public interest. And that definitely seems like a tough road for the AAP because their argument is that it's in the public interest that copyright law give, you know, free rein to publishers to withhold digital works or to seriously upcharge taxpayers for public library access. And this in the midst of a pandemic, no less. And of course, we should point out the law in Maryland passed unanimously. So think about what that says about where the public interest might be, right? So there's a ton to digest here. It's kind of a fascinating lawsuit. And I'm sure when we come back in January, we'll have a lot more to report on.
For the latest issue of PW, Andrew, you round up the top 10 stories in the library world for 2021. The Maryland ebook law ranked number 2 on your list. Tell us a little bit more about your rundown, and I hope you can tell us what came in as number 1.
So yeah, it was a fascinating year for libraries once again. And one quick note, I'll say that, you know, our top 10, the PW top 10 library stories, because we obviously deal in the publishing space, skews towards the issues where librarians and publishers coexist. And that's a pretty broad swath. So if you're looking for other library-related issues, we may not, you know, have them in our top 10. Mostly it's focused on the publishing market. But I will tell you what's number one, and you won't be surprised to know that it's about the recent wave of book banning. Because every week we seem to have more headlines about this troubling wave of book bannings across the country. But again, I'll stress this point because we've made it a couple times on this show now. it's about book banning, but it's not really necessarily about the books, right? But about using the books as a cudgel in a political battle to win control of, you know, local elections, local school boards. And as I said, you see it every week now where new challenges are being made, particularly against books on race or LGBTQ issues, and they're clearly designed to animate voters at the local level. And while many organizations have been eager to step up recently with advocacy and letter writing campaigns, I have to say this really does demand a deeper response. You know, for freedom to read advocates, and I know I'm among them, and I'm pretty sure you're among them, Chris, it really demands that we show up. So I'm not going to ruin the rest of the list for you. I hope you'll take a look at it. Go to the PW site and check it out yourselves. No pun intended. But I will take this opportunity to wish you and all of our listeners a happy and safe holiday season. You know, this was a remarkable year covering the book business, our 10th year doing this podcast. And you know, I just want to thank you, Chris, and Copyright Clearance Center for hosting this conversation every week. And Jeremy Brisky, thank you as well. And again, thanks to our listeners. I look forward to our next chat in 2022.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly Senior Writer, thanks for joining me on the program today and throughout all of 2021. I always enjoy speaking with you.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, in the final weeks of the year, CCC's podcast series will look back at the past 12 months. A common observation on the COVID-19 pandemic is that the virus has illuminated the fractures and failures in society. In the teeth of tragedy, we can see what we have long ignored and now requires our immediate attention. While economic growth and scientific advancements in our digital age rely on technology, it's now clearer than ever that everyone's full participation in innovation is crucial. Jeff Joseph, president of Washington, D.C.-based SIIA, the principal U.S. trade association for the software and digital content industries, told me why diversity, equity, and inclusion in hiring practices and business culture will accelerate advancement of all kinds.
We know that the more input we have into ideas, to the development of ideas, the more input we can have into innovation, the better the outcomes. So improving our outcomes on DEI is not just the morally and socially responsible thing to do. It's a good business decision. I often joke that imagine if Alexa couldn't understand a Bostonian or a Baltimore accent, you'd miss out on that entire market. So wouldn't you want product development to be as inclusive as possible to represent a wider array of views, and not just views in difference of ethnicity or gender, but also political views and social views to create a better outcome that can provide you with the broadest market possible.
2021, the year in review, coming on the next CCC podcast. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts, and please do follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening, and join us again soon for another Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.